All right, so let's jump into it, shall we? Well, since this is interactive, we're just going to start by just kind of getting the ball rolling here a little bit and ask for someone to give the summary of the book of Exodus and the summary of the theme of the story. So what happens in the book of Exodus? Kind of like what's the picture as we lead into Exodus, the main actions that happen during Exodus, and then where are we at when the book ends? So I want to jump in and start with that. Oh boy, it's going to be a long day if no one's going to do anything.
Summary of Exodus. So basically it starts out where Israel is in Egypt, and basically they were there for a long time, and they get to a point where Pharaoh doesn't remember Joseph and everything like that. So they've grown to a great nation, and then they basically... Pharaoh and the reigning powers start to oppress them and everything like that. And so God basically, through Moses, calls them out of Egypt, basically trashes on the Egyptian gods and says, no, I'm the one true God, brings them out, and then basically makes a covenant with Israel, basically obey my voice and I will bless you. But then it goes into some of those descriptions, and that's in terms of the law, the Ten Commandments, statutes, judgments, etc. And we get to a point where Israel says they'll do it, but then they have some issues in terms of going back and forth where, I'm forgetting the end of the book, but that's where I've
got
right
good.
Now.
That's pretty good summary.
Okay. Yeah. Moses dies? No, that's Deuteronomy.
that's the wrong Bible study. We can't go that far. Yeah, the same sort of thing. But also, I think an important concept in the book of Exodus is the fact that this is the birth of the nation. So they were a great people before, but as they're called out and planted in a spot, this is the birth of the nation of Israel. And it ends with the glory coming down onto the tabernacle. That's where the story ends there. Now, does someone now want to take a stab at the main theological elements of the book of Exodus? What is God trying to teach us in this story? So we have the lessons of the actions that are happening, but what is kind of the theological theme of the book of Exodus? So I want to take a stab at that. Miss Lindsay, Miss Massey?
I think one of the big themes is to trust God. He's got this. He's the greater power than anything you could come up with elsewise.
Absolutely. Anyone else want to add anything to that? Of course, this is a big thought as we're going into the Passover, and that is the coming out of slavery, coming out of sin. That is, of course, one of the main concepts here. And there's a cycle here that is really highlighted in the book of Exodus, and that is of exile and exodus. We're going to talk a lot about that because there's a lot of connection points between that in the book of Exodus and the book of Matthew, and then, of course, throughout the whole Bible. And also another major theme, theological theme, that is referenced again in the New Testament is Moses being a form of a deliverer and a form of an intercessor. So that's certainly going to come up again later. All right, so I wanted to just start off a little bit by talking about how we're going to combine these two books, both kind of thematically and structurally between the two. And so one concept that I wanted to make sure is fresh in our minds is the concept of reoccurring themes. And, I kind of want to expand on this one day in a full message, but when someone mentioned this in one of the podcasts I was listening to, I thought it was a brilliant idea when I heard of it. And they said that you should read through the Bible like it's a fictional novel. Now, not to say that the Bible is fiction, right? We're not saying that at all. But a lot of times when we read through the Bible, we read through it like a textbook. Like we're jumping into a part, we're getting whatever that specific point is, and then we kind of pull that out and move on. Almost like we're preparing for a test. So it's almost like a textbook. But if you read through the Bible like a fictional novel, a couple of extra things pop out that are missing otherwise. And there are specific translations, and there are even specific ways people have compiled the Bible to make this happen a lot easier. But if you read through the Bible like it is fiction, then you understand that some themes and some situations are telegraphed. And what I mean by that is if you're reading a book of fiction and in the introduction, the character has like a weird habit or like this weird skill or something like that, Well, you know it's going to come back up later, right? So the writer's not putting something in that novel that wouldn't be useful information later on. So it's being telegraphed. And the Bible is no different in how it also does this as well. If something is in the Bible, the writers often put something there, so it's telegraphed a connection later. In one of the books I was reading, one of the fiction books I was reading, the main character, he during the introduction, he has a story of a boat that catches fire. And like he keeps having these vivid dreams of boats catching in fire. And then by the time you get to the climax of the book, a boat comes into the scene and your mind is already primed to know that something's going to happen, right? Because it's, again, been telegraphed from start to finish. And again, this happens in the Bible all of the time. There are tons of examples of this, but one I wanted to point out specifically is the concept of going up on a mountain. Going up on a mountain. In Exodus chapter 19, and you can kind of hold your place in Exodus and Matthew because we're going to be going back and forth there a million times. But in Exodus chapter 19, that's one of the first times where God calls Moses to go up the mountain. That is a physical thing. He has to go up on the Mount of Sinai. And we get all these instructions, including the Ten Commandments and all this. And in chapter 24, still in Exodus, Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, they do the same thing. God calls them up to the mountain. So going up to the mountain, that is a common refrain in the Bible. And it is used as a literal sense, like they literally went up Mount Sinai, but it is also used to thematically make a connection that they are going to receive divine law and instruction. So again, there's a literal sense, and then there's the symbolic term. So the phrase going up on a mountain, it's used 24 times in the Septuagint. So just to refresh our memory, the Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. We're going to talk about that a lot because the audience of Matthew had the Septuagint. So going up on a mountain is used 24 times in the Septuagint, 18 times in the Pentateuch, 14 in Sinai specifically, and 11 of them are applying directly to Moses, an action that Moses has taken. So the reason for that is there is imagery that is set here. And so by the time we get to the book of Matthew, when Matthew uses those words, he's trying to telegraph something. So there are five significant events in Jesus Christ's life where he's going to really expound on a spiritual principle and a teaching. And all five of those, he goes up on a mountain. So the first one, first of all, does anyone have any guesses as to what those are? The Sermon on the Mount. That one's, it's in the title, so that one's pretty good. What else? You want us to know if any other ones? Well, that's Matthew 5. Then there is a section of healings. That's in Matthew 15, verses 29 through 31. There's a transfiguration. That's a big one. That's Matthew 17. Jesus' final discourse. He goes up on the Mount of Olives. That's Matthew 24 and verse 3. And then the commissioning of the apostles at the end, that's Matthew 28, verses 16 through 20. There's one more that we're going to talk about a little bit more. That's in the temptations. That's in Matthew chapter 5. So a Jewish listener to Matthew's account would immediately make those connections. That's the point I'm trying to draw out, is because they're telegraphed beforehand. The other part, before we jump into these connections, is the cultural context that the audience at that time had when the book of Matthew was written. So on the handout, I kind of put just a brief summary of the different gospels and the audience that they were writing to. And does anyone want to take a stab at what's different about Matthew versus the rest of the gospels? That's right. It is to the Jewish people. Some have referred to it as the most Jewish book of the Bible, because that is what the audience is for, that is where the audience is coming from, and that is the most connections he's making to their Jewish heritage. Anyone else have any differences? So on the handout, there's one that is more clear there of him calling Jesus the son of David. There's the six times in the handout. That's more than any other book, because again, he's connecting Jesus back into their heritage. But when we're talking about the cultural context, I don't want to dive too deep into this, but other than to reiterate that the cultural context of the audience of the writer was very important. Now, I want to make sure and be clear and say that, you know, the Bible is timeless, obviously. Anyone from any time can pick up the Bible and read everything that they need to have the opportunity to be in God's family, if God is calling them and giving them the Holy Spirit. You don't need any sort of mystical understanding. You don't need any super codes or something like that to unlock any passwords or something like that. But with that being said, the cultural context is very important. And I want to give an example. This is one that Kurt Hoyer was talking to me about, and Brian Drawbaugh mentioned the same thing. And they said, they talked about the difficulties of explaining the days of unleavened bread to people of the Philippines, or people in Asia, in the case of Brian Drawbaugh. And that is because they don't eat bread, right? Rice is their main staple. So if you're not around bread, you don't eat bread, you don't bake bread, then you don't get that same analogy of yeast and leaven in the same way. Now, that doesn't mean that they had to like go back to school and dedicate their life to agriculture or become some sort of a bread chef or something like that. I'm sure that Kurt and Brian explained it perfectly well to them. But when it's not in your culture, some things, some of those connections just don't hit in the exact same way. And in the first century, when Matthew is writing his book, the Jews at that time were waiting for the Messiah, in which Moses was the forerunner of, and they would have that connection to different parts of Matthew's audience. So let's look at one example in Matthew chapter 2. This is in Matthew chapter 2, and this is verses 19 through 20. Matthew chapter 2, 19 and 20. It says, "But when Herod was dead, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying," verse 20, "Arise, take the young child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who sought the young child's life are dead." Now that phrase, "those that sought the young child's life," and the Septuagint verse of Exodus 4, verse 19, again, that's the Greek translation of the Old Testament, which they had. In Exodus 4, 19, the Septuagint says, "all the men who sought your life are dead." So those two phrases are nearly identical. There's just one minor difference there in the text. So it doesn't hit us in the same way because our translations are a little bit different, but also because we aren't living in a culture that is waiting for this new Moses, and that connection to Matthew isn't quite as strong as it would have been for that audience. For that audience, that connection was 100% telegraphed and as Jesus Christ being a type of Moses. So we have this typology of Moses and Jesus having to flee because their life is threatened, and then when the time is right, they come back into the picture and restart their mission. That's the connection that Matthew is making to his audience. But let's notice another one in Matthew chapter 11. Does anyone want to read this one? Matthew 11, it's just three, four verses, starting in verse 3 of Matthew 11. Any takers? All right, Matthew 3:11 says, "And say to him," before I even start this, I think this is a great example of one, because when we're reading through this without that cultural context, it kind of seems like Jesus' answer doesn't make any sense. Or like, we can kind of get what he's saying, but it doesn't feel like he really answered the question. Matthew 11, verse 3, "And say to him, are you the coming one, or do we look for another?" They're asking Jesus this. Verse 4, "Jesus answered and said to them, go and tell John these things which you hear and see. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. And blessed is he who is not offended because of me." All right, so why did Jesus answer in this way? Anyone want to take a stab at that? We should have had more coffee for kind of fire us up here. Well, this kind of seems like it should be a straightforward answer, like yes or no. Like, are you the Messiah or not? And Jesus doesn't give a straightforward answer. And maybe he didn't want to, maybe he wanted it a little bit veiled, but the answer he gives is not like a wink-wink sort of thing. Like, I'm not going to say yes, but like, I'm really kind of saying it is kind of yes. Daniel, please.
Right out of Isaiah
Yes, that's right. So again, remember Matthew is writing to the Jewish audience that knows it's right from the Torah. And they're well-versed, and they're eagerly expecting this deliverance. So Jesus Christ, he's quoting the Old Testament saying, you know the conditions and the actions of the Messiah, so you can judge for yourself whether I fit that or not. Now, when the audience heard that back in the day, they had no ambiguity as to what Jesus Christ was saying, even though his response may seem a little strange to us because we don't have that same cultural context. Okay, so let's jump into some of these different connections. I would like someone to take a stab at this, and it's a question on our sheet, and that is, what do we mean when we say exile and exodus? What do those terms mean? Mr. Shaper.
Exile is being driven out, and by exodus, that was their God leading them out. It was usually, if you're exiled, it's not on good terms with the government.
Yep.
They were not on good terms, but there was hardly any government left.
Right. Any other want to take a stab at that? So I'm trying to telegraph here that these themes of exile and exodus are very important, not only in our connection between the book of Exodus and Matthew, but as we're going to see here, throughout the whole Bible. Does anyone else want to take a stab at those connections?
Exile, as Mr. Shaver said, right, it's being forced out where you don't really want to go versus Exodus is like purposeful thing. So in terms of a connection between Exodus and Matthew, where Jesus is coming to help lead the way out of sin from that Exodus side versus pushing people into a certain situation where exile, like thinking about how God, you know, sent Judah into captivity, that was sort of the exile, mm-hmm. Where it was their sin pushing them into exile versus leading them out of sin.
Yeah, that's a great one. So in my mind, go ahead, Mr. Shaper.
There's also an attitude. In exile, you're being forced. It's never a good thing.
That's
you
right.
Don't have a smile on your face.
Right.
You don't go out happy. The Exodus was, in fact, that. They went out happy.
Yeah, this is off topic, but when we went to the museum in London when we were there, and they have a relief, and it's one of the pictures of the Israelites being led off into captivity, and they're pierced through the ear or through the nose, I forget now, and they're being led out. And they did not look pleased in that relief. They did not look happy at all. When I think of exile and exodus, I think of it in these terms. Sin and being separated from God is you are in exile. You're being exiled away from God, and the solution to that is an exodus back to God. You're moving out of exodus back into a relationship with God. And throughout the Bible, that cycle repeats over and over and over again. So if we think that just in terms of the Bible as a literary work, the very first story we get is Adam and Eve being exiled from the garden. That happens again with Cain being further exiled, the nations at Babel being exiled again. And the Exodus, as its position, just as a literary work, it highlights the remedy to this. The nation of Israel, by a mighty hand, was brought out of Egypt, given a fresh start in that relationship, and then was to be planted in the promised land as a model nation for all those around them, to have that covenant relationship. And the prodigal son parable in Luke chapter 15, that is explaining the same sort of cycle all over again. So the next question I have is also on the sheet, and that is, why did the Israelites come out the way they did? Why did God bring them out that way? The question is about, why did Pharaoh harden their heart? Why did God even allow that to happen in the first place? And think about it in terms of this context of what we're talking about between exile and exodus. So why did God bring out the Israelites in the way he did?
Well, I don't know if this is what you're looking for, but I think first and foremost is he had to show everyone it had to be him. it couldn't have been man-made in any fashion.
Yes. All the way back, Mr. Kasperson.
I think along those same lines, it's to teach them to rely on him. And then that, I don't want to get ahead of things, but then the whole like going through the wilderness is similar. I mean, they had to rely on God for the light to, or the pillar of fire, the pillar of smoke to guide them through the desert. They would have died on their own.
Any more thoughts about why God hardened Pharaoh's heart? This is a question that comes up a lot, especially if you're looking at, like, in terms of scholarly articles trying to explain this. Ms. Massey's ready.
I'm not sure. I'm looking at it exactly how many times, but at least the first four plagues and maybe the sixth or seventh too, Pharaoh hardened his own heart.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But then I think time and time again throughout Exodus, God talks about how his purpose here is to show his great power, that everyone would believe he is who he says he was. And I think he was not done. And so in that sense, he strengthened Pharaoh to be able to kind of endure in his stubbornness, even though as a man it seemed like he was breaking down. So God hardened his heart, which is a really weird way of thinking. He strengthened him to be able to be resilient until God can complete his plan of what he was really looking to do.
Right.
Yeah, I read that fortified, right? That's a better word. That's a better kind of thing. Fortify him, let him
continue in his hardenedness.
That's right. God strengthened his heart, fortified his heart. But it kind of goes a little bit in conflict of what we would think about God in some senses. You know, it's like he's almost propping Pharaoh up so that he can smash him back down again. So I wanted to point out one thing about that process of taking him out, having to harden Pharaoh's heart so he can get the Israelites out. And that is the difference between political freedom and redemption of God's people. So if this was simple political freedom, like he just wanted to take those people and put them over here to start their own nation, then you would expect for him to soften Pharaoh's heart, right? So he's going to take them out, he's going to plant them as their own nation, and they would have been politically delivered. But the key event in this whole scenario is the Passover. So the Passover is demonstrating that there is a redemption of his people. Is different than just a liberty. Now, God didn't just set his people free, which of course he certainly did, but he delivered them from death by the shedding of the lamb's blood. He was redeeming them back to himself. And that was somewhat lost also in the audience of Matthew's day, because they were waiting for that new Moses type of Messiah that would come and liberate them from the Romans. So they were also looking for political liberation from the Romans at that time. And of course, that's not what Jesus came to do in that time. And Matthew takes plain and makes many steps to help make that connection. That's part of what Matthew's trying to accomplish, that Jesus is the new Moses, but he's coming for a specific purpose, that spiritual redemption, not political liberation. All right, so let's jump into our specific connection points now. I've got eight on there. Maybe you've thought about a couple other you want to add back in as well. I'm going to start by jumping to B. We'll come back to Matthew number one in just a little bit if we have time. But the second one is the birth and the infancy story. So that's in Matthew chapter 2, and it's cross-referenced with Exodus chapter 1. Now, who can explain the similarities between those two stories?
Pharaoh is killing off all the newborn males in Egypt in Exodus, and Herod is killing off all the newborn males that are a threat to his power and the town he sees.
Absolutely right. Yeah, there's a clear connection there between Herod and Pharaoh that Matthew is making. Any other thoughts on that one? All right, let's go to the next one, Matthew chapter 4, the temptations. Temptations. And you might not have thought about it in this exact same context here. Who can draw some parallels between the temptations in Matthew 4 and the story in Exodus? Did anyone pick up those connections? Mr. Casperson?
So I don't know if this is kind of what you're looking for, a bit of a shot in the dark, but in terms of temptations, we have the whole Egyptian society tempting the Israelites the entire time that they're in slavery there. I mean, and then we have obviously the temptation of Christ by the devil in Matthew. And then you also have, as they're coming out of Egypt, they pillaged the Egyptians, right? And they took all of this stuff that could have, like, shows them what that sinful living and what Egyptian society could have gotten them, or would have gotten them if they followed the new ways of the Egyptians. So in a way, they're tempted with what's in their hands.
Anyone else have a connection there? Mr. Massey?
So when Moses went up to Mount Sinai for 40 days and 40 nights, he fasted. What was going on down in the camp in Israel was that they had set up the golden calf. So the devil was having his way with his Israelite society at that time, and Jesus kind of stands out as the Moses figure in that he was able to resist the devil's temptation, fasting for 40 days and 40 nights.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that, fasting 40 days and 40 nights. So all three of the Gospels have, all three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, have this story of Jesus being led away and being tempted. But Matthew doubles down on Christ fasting for 40 days and 40 nights. The other Gospels either mention that he just kind of fasted or that he was tempted for 40 days. So that correlates back to Exodus 34 and verses 28. That's when Moses goes and he gets that second set of commandments. Moses also fasted 40 days and 40 nights. Matthew's making sure that connection is super clear here. But also when we talk about the form of those temptations, both were the nation of Israel and Christ were called out into the desert to be tempted. Israel, when they were on their way to Mount Sinai, they were tempted by hunger, which is Exodus chapter 16. They were tempted to test God. That's Exodus 17. And then they were tested with idolatry, which is Exodus 32, which is the golden calf. So part of that connection here is where God's firstborn son of Israel failed in those temptations. God's firstborn son of Jesus succeeded. So Jesus proves himself to be true by passing all of those temptations, whereas the Israelites failed. Any other thoughts on that one? All right, Matthew chapter 5, the Sermon on the Mount. Anyone have any connections there? This one, I think there's only a couple, one little connection here. We kind of already talked about it, but we talked about the concept of going up on a mountain. And this, of course, is also supposed to call to mind Exodus chapter 19, where they go up to the mountain. Moses goes up to receive divine teaching and divine instruction. Here, Jesus Christ is going up on a mountain, like we said, to deliver divine teaching, to do the divine clarification of the law and add to it. The next one on the list, Matthew chapter 8, verses 23 through 27. Did anyone pick up this connection? This one's a little bit more esoteric. Matthew chapter 8, verses 23 through 27. The wind and the sea obey him. Any takers on this one? Well, go ahead, Mrs. Massey.
Stretches out his rod, the hail comes, he stretches out his rod, the water turns into blood, it cleanses, he's controlling the elements, God through him, through stretching out his hand, which is kind of what Jesus does with speech too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. So this should be fresh in our minds here as we went through the story of the Exodus just recently, but the One of the biggest examples of the wind and the sea obeying God, of course, is when they went through the Red Sea. So that connects directly back to Exodus chapter 14, verses 21 and 22, like Mrs. Massey was referring to. In that section, it says it's explicitly that the east wind came and the water piled up on both sides, so the wind and the sea obeyed God. And we don't have to turn back there, but in John 6, verses 16 through 20, I think it's illegal for us to do that because we're staying in Matthew. But in that case, when Jesus calms the storm, there's kind of a fun play on words there. And only kind of when you're thinking about it in this context does it make it obvious. But Jesus says, as he's kind of walking out on the water, he walks out and he says, "It is I, do not be afraid." Again, that of course is reassuring them that he's not, you know, a spirit. That was the primary goal there, and he wasn't a ghost. But it's actually also a literary connection back to the connection of the I am. So he's making that connection to Exodus at the same time there as well. Matthew chapter 14 and 15. Matthew chapter 14 and 15. This one should be pretty straightforward. It's kind of on the nose here. Any takers on 14 and 15? All right, so the story in Matthew 14 and 15 is the multiplication of food, the supernatural appearance of food, and that's, of course, telegraphed back to Exodus chapter 16 with the manna. That, again, is another case of supernatural appearance of food. And you also might want to jot down in the section John 6 and verse 14. John 6, verse 14, that's a parallel account to the story. And in that case, the people did make the connection back between the two. So in that time, they connected and they said, "Oh, here is a prophet." So they're making that connection that Jesus, so it wasn't like he was kind of, in my mind, when I originally read the story, I kind of felt like he was kind of doing it privately, like breaking off bread, and like people didn't notice that the bread just kind of never ran out. But the people did, and they made that connection back to this is a type of prophet. All right, the next one, this is a big one, Matthew chapter 17. That's the transfiguration. There's a whole lot of connections here. And this one, if you were to ask people about connections in Matthew, this one jumps out at you because Moses is in the story. So it's, of course, connected back there. But does anyone want to take a stab at the different connections here? I have five or six different connections. First, Mr. Schaefer, and then Mr. Casperson. Either way, dealer pick.
Jesus started to glow, and Moses' face also glowed.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I was specifically going to reference the burning bush being one, and then where Mr. Schaefer talked about his face afterwards. And then I forget exactly where it is, but at one point, or this might actually not be in Exodus, but when Moses asked God to reveal himself to him, and God said, "Well, I'll pass by you, but I'm going to look away from you." And so you have two examples there.
Cool. Anyone else have a connection there? There's a couple more in there, too. Run over to Miss Britt.
It's another going up onto a mountain.
Yep, another going up on a mountain. Yep. Any other takers? There's a couple more in here, too. So up on a mountain, of course, that connects back to Exodus 24. After 6 days, that terminology is directly in both. Matthew 17, verses 1, Exodus 24, and verse 16. In the Matthew account, we have Peter, James, and John. In the Exodus account, we have Aaron, Nahab, and Abihu. The sets of three. That's Matthew 17, 1, and Exodus 24, 1. We already mentioned Jesus' face shining like the sun. That's connected back to Moses as well, Exodus 24:30. We also have the cloud covering. That's in both, Matthew 17:5. We also have God calling out of the cloud. And then I want someone to read Matthew 17, verse 5. And when you do, if you could also say what translation you're reading it in. Matthew 17, verse 5. Someone want to do that?
I've got a New King James.
Okay, perfect.
While he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and suddenly a voice came out of the cloud saying, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear him."
Okay, so that connects back with Deuteronomy chapter 18 and verse 15. I'll read that one out, but you can jot that one down. So see if this rings true here. Deuteronomy 18, verse 15. It says, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your midst, from your brethren, him you shall hear." So that's the connection point back. Him you shall hear, or also says him you shall listen. And then in Matthew 17, verse 5, same thing, listen to him. That is those are the same two words in the Septuagint. Those are the same two words. So that, of course, would have made sense to the audience at that time. All right, the last one that I have on the list is Matthew 26. That's the Last Supper and Passover. Who wants to make that connection? No one. All right, well, I think those connections are pretty straightforward. I don't think there's a lot of debate in that. Jesus Christ being the Lamb, and all the Last Supper events and the Passover Lamb, those are pretty obvious connecting back. Did anyone come up with other connections that I didn't mention that they wanted to talk about? Yeah, Ms. Massey? All right, let's go back to point one. Let's go back to Matthew chapter one. This is 100% more esoteric. So before we talk about this one, I'll say that this one is more speculative in nature. So keep that big giant asterisk in mind before we talk about this one. And this one is more kind of hotly contested among different scholars of that topic. Okay, so in Matthew chapter one, we have the genealogy. And then when we get down to verse 17, it says, "So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. From David until captivity in Babylon are 14 generations. And from the captivity in Babylon until Christ are 14 generations." Okay, so does anyone have any thoughts on that just straight out first? Has anyone gone through and counted the names first? All right, so if you have gone through and counted that, you'll realize the last set only has 13 names. There's only 13 in there. You have to kind of do some fancy double counting to make that work. And so the several commentators are pointing out, well, even before we go that, the list that's here is intentional. So it's not a complete list, right? If you go through and you just flip back and forth between the books of Kings and Chronicles, you'll know that they left out some names. And most commentaries will say that is intentional. The spelling of names is a little bit different in here as well. And some commentators point to this concept of gematria, or where the number and the names matches. So we won't talk about that, but there are some commentaries that say that the list of names in the last set is 13 intentionally. And what Matthew is trying to project to the audience here is that they are still in exile. They're still waiting. That cycle has not yet been completed. So that is what most commentaries would say there, because the first century Jews at that time, they didn't feel like they were fully out of that exile. That they returned from Babylon, but only two tribes returned from Babylon, and there was no day of the Lord. There's none of the other promises that we know about as the full fulfillment of this. So they're still waiting for this. And so many commentators will say that Matthew here is projecting that on them to prep them for the story of Christ coming here by leaving them hanging in that last set. So like I said, that's more speculative. Some commentators will disagree with that, but I thought that was interesting enough to include that in the connections. You can debate that among yourselves. Any other connections that we missed? All right, well, I do want to just kind of wrap a little bit of a bow at the end of this Bible study and kind of try to tie it back into our own lives. So hopefully this information was at least a little bit interesting before, but if it doesn't tie back to our lives, it just stays interesting and it doesn't stay all that useful. But the main point I wanted to call out is that the Bible is full of this cycle of exile and exodus. And that is one of the main themes. Now, in the book of the Exodus, of course, that's the main part of that book, but that cycle really explains mankind's existence on the earth as a central theme. And that's one that hopefully we can directly relate to as we take part of the Passover and as we recommit to a relationship with God. So we all have sinned, we all have separated ourselves from God, and we want to be drawn back into that relationship. So there is a literary critic of the Bible named Northrop Frye, and he said this about the Bible. He's just talking about the Bible as a literary work. And he said, quote, that the Exodus is the only thing that happens in the Bible. So the point that he's trying to make, that everything comes back to this cycle. It starts with Adam and Eve, and it just keeps rolling throughout time all the way till you get to Revelation, where the cycle is finally ended, because that relationship is completed and perfected. But also through that same cycle, God is continually painting the picture of what type of relationship he wants to have with us, how he wants to be known by us. As we referenced it a little bit earlier, when they were coming out of Egypt, one of the big things that God was trying to do was to teach not only Israel, but Egypt and all the nations around him who he was and what he was all about. So much so that by the time they got all the way to the land of Canaan and Jericho, there were people there that already knew about God and what God had done. That was one of the goals of taking them out in the way that they did. Now, I want to end back in Exodus chapter 6 and verse 6. Now, this is very clearly connected to the physical nation of Israel as they exited out of Egypt and as they went into the promised land. But I think we can see the spiritual principle that is the true undercurrent of what's happening here. Exodus chapter 6, and read verses 6 and 7. Exodus chapter 6. It says, therefore, say to the children of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptian. I will rescue you from your bondage, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. I will take you as my people, and I will be your God. And then you shall know that I am the Lord your God, who brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. So I like to propose that cycle still continues to this day and will continue all the way through until it is finally completed as pictured in Revelation.